Before we continue, there will be a slight change to our agenda. After the briefing from the department, there will also be another briefing from the NPA. I'd like the members to note that. Without any waste of time, I will introduce the members of the committee and hand over to the DG to introduce his team and then continue with the briefing. I am Chair Tamofukeng, the chairperson of the CEDAW Committee on Security and Constitutional Development.
Thank you. Matrome Hamfrimukhobi, member of the committee. I'm Gerald Matila, member of the committee.
My name is Dennis Bloom. I'm the only Khoisan chief here in Parliament from the Free State.
Good morning. I'm Lorenzo Mande from KwaZulu-Natal, Msunduzi.
Thanks.
Good morning. My name is Edwin Chane. I'm the member of the committee.
Good morning. I'm Jack Becker from the Western Cape.
Good morning. My name is Wati Watson from the Mpumalanga Province.
Thank you, honorable members. We also have two support staff members. This is the secretary of the committee, Gershon Dixon, and the researcher sitting there, Patricia Wittes. Over to you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Chief President, honorable members of the committee. Thank you for inviting us to come and present to you this morning. As the chair said, the department is here represented by myself from the national office and Dr. Desir from the NPA and his team. Karen on my right will help me do the presentation. Mr. Jacob, the DPP for the Western Cape, is here. Mogile Mzinyati, the acting head of the National Prosecution Service from NPA, Mr. Musala, Mr. Holomby, assisting the acting CEO, Dr. Desir, and the NPA. Mr. Shabalala Yongzuzu is the DDG for Corporate Services in the National Office. Didi Modise, from National Office, was seconded to the NPA. And to serve there as an executive manager for HR. She's there now in a permanent position. I will propose to go through the National Office presentation, Chair, and Dr. Devia will present specifically the program relating to the NPA. The presentation was circulated. I propose to present to the strategic plan at the macro level and the indication of the budget and how we spend on the budget. The vision and mission statements are there for everybody to see the laudable values there, promoting accessibility and transform justice services is our vision. And as you know, a vision is something you never actually achieve, but you always strive for it, and that's what gives you the purpose to do whatever you do, just to try and strive for something that you actually never achieve. The mission statement, talk to us working together to do more and achieve more in this context for accessible, fair, speedy, and cost-effective quality justice for everyone. There are three strategic goals for the department. The first one being access to justice, which is our core strategic objective, and a number of programs that relate to this strategic objective. The primary one being the building of courts. In other words, from the history of our country, we know that most of the courts are in the main area. You know, your main cities have nice big infrastructure. But as you go out to the townships, you don't find the same infrastructure. If you find it, it's infrastructure that is of a lesser quality than the one you find in the main city. And then if you go even further to rural areas, you hardly find courts at all. And we have in many places what are called, and you see the various presentations that are called mobile courts, which basically are the mobile infrastructure that can be purchased, customized, and is placed on open land. So it could serve the purpose for what we want to do. But ideally what we need to do going forward is to ensure that all communities are served and are serviced through courts that are properly built, properly constructed, so that all our people have the knowledge that the government treats them equally. So building courts is one of the key strategic objectives. The other one is ensuring that we use in the court all the languages in the country. Traditionally, as you know, in South Africa, the main language of the court have been two languages, English and Afrikaans. So we have a phenomenon of court interpreters, where everywhere really courts must have interpreters to interpret. Largely, it's a framework that was designed to accommodate the people that appear before court, as it were, in that if they didn't speak the language that the presiding officer or the prosecution, if it was a criminal case, spoke, you'd be assisted with an interpreter. That's the mindset that we're introducing now, is a different mindset that says everybody should speak their own language. Court proceedings must be run in a language that is, you know, common in that area. If it's the Western Cape or Northern Cape, for example, there should be no reason why court proceedings proceed in English when all the parties involved speak Afrikaans. Proceedings should proceed in Afrikaans. If you are in Kwaku, there's a court there and there's a matter running. If the presiding officer speaks to the accused, speaks to the lawyers, and the prosecutor speaks to Sutu, there's no reason why those court proceedings should run in any other language but Sutu, that type of thing. So we started with the judiciary, the NPA, and ourselves, a framework in terms of which we ensure that where it is possible that the full proceedings run in any one language that all the parties involved in comfortable engaging in, that's the language, and then we provide the record differently. The other strategic objective two talks to the enhancement of organizational efficiency. What we really are talking about there are attempts to ensure that the services that we provide are provided not only as efficiently as possible, but in a manner that is user-friendly for everyone. Again, it is a mindset that changes. The most basic program that will ensure here to assist us achieve our objectives is to really fill vacancies, vacant posts, create posts where they need to be created, fill them, and then make sure that the environment is properly capacitated. And we build that human resource to make sure that people are able to do what they are employed to do. And we also want to make sure that in that environment we are able to manage our finances properly, because there's a lot of focus on corruption and so forth. But one of the areas that we need to pay strong attention is waste and use control, because you can have the resources, you cannot be involved in corrupt activities and so forth, but you can be sort of thoroughly wasteful in the way you use your resources. So we want to make sure that we've got very good management practices and financial practices going on. The most important is the second last from bottom, modernizing information technology systems. Again, being a phenomenon from our history, our processes in the court and the manner in which court proceedings were done were never really done in an environment that ensured that there was the efficiency that we're talking about. Simply because the methods that we used were manual methods. You know, if you went to court, if you've been there, you'd recall that at the front there, in front of the presiding officer, there'd be what are called stenographers, people that would make sure that the tape is put and removed and so forth and so forth. We still have something akin to this, but we've moved further with technology. We now have digitalized systems. so that the recording is as accurate as possible. And we keep the records for longer on disk. And, you know, the system really runs itself. And the person that is sitting there, clerk, will really be there to make sure that the machine is working, as opposed largely to operating the system as the case used to be. So we're trying to use information technology to make sure that services are proper. Also to make sure that we audit the work that we do, and we audit the work that our officials do, so that we can make interventions where necessary. With respect to the criminal cases, for example, the phenomenon of stolen dockets used to be one of the main points about court, that a docket goes missing in court. We've cured that problem because the information in the charge sheet and in the dockets almost all the time gets scanned into the system. So if a docket goes missing for some reason or cannot be found for whatever reason, we're able to simply go into the system and retrieve and the matter can continue. Whereas in the past, as soon as it is gone, that's the end of the matter. So it's a bit difficult. So if somebody is interested in seeing the docket, they'll have to do it at a different place. They'll have to make the intervention at a different place. But once it goes to court, the prosecution and the court will make sure that information is properly captured. So we're still developing this system just to make sure that, again, all of the criminal justice and civil justice processes that that take place in South Africa are provided electronically. The third strategic goal on transformation of society, the state, and justice as a whole. These are interventions that are really wide-ranging. The ones that I think are worthy of note there, it's legislation development. There's quite a number of pieces of legislation that have been brought to bear through this parliament, the Child Justice Act being one of them, which becomes effective in the new year, establishing a completely new criminal justice system for juveniles. In other words, juveniles will not be taken through the criminal justice system and processes that we know. That legislation establishes their own, and the primary focus there would be to divert cases as opposed to going through court proceedings. The other bills that you may be familiar with that talk towards judicial transparency, they've been called bills, you know, they've been written about a lot in the media. You know, the criticism has been the extent to which government may be seen to be undermining judicial independence. Those bills are in the legislative program of the department this year. They were in the past and they're back again. And we're going to make sure that the courts are rationalized in line with constitutional requirements. Chapter 9 institutions are also part of our program. And through them, we promote the values in the Constitution and constitutional development as a whole. So the programs, therefore, in the department that make the Department of Justice are five programs. The first one being administration. I've spoken about how we're trying to create field vacancies. There, what I'm bringing before the committee is the fact that we currently have 2,741, you know, vacancies, and our target is to try and reduce those vacancies. They vary in level from the entry-level position at grade 2 or 3 to the highest position, you know, level 15 in some cases. And that's the most important thing that we're trying to do. There are, in the work, in the nature of the work that we do, instances where we have to take discipline against people where we find that there is no consistency in the carrying out of our work with our prescripts or public service regulations. And at this point in time, there's about 240 disciplinary cases underway, and there's 287 grievances. All of which we are trying to deal with within 6 months. Not all of them are dealt with within 6 months. Some take quite longer than that, depending on the complexity and the nature of matters. But really, it is something that we're trying hard to deal with. We also focus on training and development of staff. It's a continuous program. It runs every year. to make sure that staff are sufficiently capacitated to be able to perform, especially if we enforce strongly the performance management system. The bottom one, efficiency in the administration of third party funds. Let's talk to money that the department holds in trust on behalf of other people, like maintenance, for example. Maintenance arises out of civil disputes between two people, and therefore those are private matters. They really don't involve government. But historically, the way the orders are given is that when a decree of divorce is granted, the order would also say to one party that that party must pay into court a certain amount of money in respect of minor children. So as a result, when that person pays into court, somebody must look after that money. So inadvertently, as a result of the court order, the department has always been then holding trust money on behalf of beneficiaries. And then the people who come, the party in whose favor the court order is made, would then come to court to check if the money has been paid as required, and the party then collects. So we have to manage the matter that does involve government, it does involve the department, but the court order, because it requires that money be paid into court, we have to manage this. So you won't, in your constituencies, come across instances of complaints where parties, mostly women, complain that either their money came late or they didn't receive it because it wasn't there. It would be because we are managing this type of issue. I'll skip through that slide. The next one talks to interventions that we have put in place to try and minimize risk, because there's money in the courts all the time. Courts become an attractive place to rob by criminals, not only during the day, actually at night. We find that many a times, in the rural areas, for example, because banks close, let's say, around half past 3 the day before, in order for the department to make maintenance payments and other payments the following day in the morning, money is received from the bank the day before and stayed overnight. Some people who become aware of this do then break into court, break it safe, and actually take that money. So, it talks to the need to have secure courts everywhere. Unfortunately, we're not able to do that, and therefore this is a problem that we face on a continuous basis. The 127 Justice Service delivery points that we're talking about there are those where we issued a tender for security, where we want to put CCTV cameras to try and manage. But it's just 127 courts out of 400 and something odd courts, so we still have a long way to go. It's 127 because the budget only allows us to target 127. And that's going to cost us this financial year about 80 million. That's what it's been budgeted for. The whole project, we estimated, is easily going to cost us between 2 and 2.2 billion. But it's something that we're going to do progressively. In the meantime, we have to find ways of managing the problem. The rollout of CCTV in all Tutuzela centers, what that talks to, is a framework where children in sexual offenses are able to give evidence through TV monitoring as opposed to being in open court and face their accused. So we try to, as much as possible, to make sure that those areas where there's a lot of those cases going on, we provide for them. That is by way of administration. With respect to court services are really talking to the work that's done in the court. So that's work that's done in the region. And what we are planning to do in the next 3 years is to build 11 new courts. I mentioned earlier, Dr. Honorable Chair, that one of the most important things is to build courts. The amount that it costs to build a reasonably sized court is at least a year and a half of 120 million. So if you are going to be putting 10 courts per annum, for example, you need to have at least 1.5 billion to do this. In any 1 year, the budget of the Department for Capital Works is at least 450 million. So, and that doesn't only cover the construction of course, it covers a whole host of others. So really, this is outstanding. Only able to really build one course per annum, which is an indicator of the type of challenges that we have from the budget perspective. It's even worse with the recession now and the scale that the government has to go through. So it's one of the things you have to manage very tightly. But on average, because these programs roll over, you know, constructing a course takes about 18 months, we open at least 5 courses per annum on the type of thing, even on this budget. It doesn't mean that all were built in 1 year, others are in different stages of completion. But generally per annum, we have 5. Our main target is to have 11 completely new in 3 years, by 2012 at least. Replacing 46 of the 230 branch courts to provide full court services. The structure of the court is like this. If I use Johannesburg as an example, the main court in Johannesburg is the Johannesburg Magistrate Court in the CBD. The Protea Court in Soweto is not a main court. It is a branch court of that main court. Until last month, the Alexander Court in Alex was a branch court of the Johannesburg. The Randburg Court was a branch court of the Johannesburg main court. In practical terms, what it means is this. All officials of justice from magistrates will be employed at the main court. So the main establishment will be at the main court. And therefore, they will then be sent to go work at a different station. So when you clock in the morning, you clock in at your main court, then you drive to Soweto, Randburg, or Alexander. That's why most of the time courts would start at 10, because it allows for that driving. And that's why courts would close at about 2:30, 3 o'clock, because people must go back to the main court and knock off. So that really has been the framework. So what we're talking about here is to say those branch courts must be converted to main courts so that they can institute, or at least the party can institute proceedings out of the main court. If you want to issue summons, you can only issue them out of the main court. That's why it's so, if you want to sue your neighbor, you can't go to Procedure Court and issue summons. You have to go to Johannesburg main court and issue summons. So this framework really reorganizes the way that the courts were structured. That's what it talks to when you talk about designation of branch courts into main courts, and then they're able to offer full set of services. The other problems that are there, clearly improving maintenance services, because it's scarce in the country. Many people don't pay maintenance when they should, and the most important thing is to trace these people that don't pay maintenance. And we're employing not at a significant level because of amongst others budget constraints, but we're employing maintenance investigators who track you down and find out. You have read in the Sowetan last week that one person who was owing maintenance of up to about 200,000 sold the house, and unfortunately when he sold the house, there was a court order for maintenance to say that all proceeds from the sale of that house must go to another maintenance. He's not going to get proceeds from the sale of his property arising out of that divorce. He's going to have to pay maintenance. So we try to do that as much as possible. It's not the core business of government to do that. It's just a service that government is instructed to offer. The people affected are vulnerable, which is children, and in some cases, vulnerable women too. So we offer that particular service. The next slide talks to reducing sexual and domestic offenses. Really through proper enforcement of the relevant legislation and making sure that they are put to prison when they are violations. The review of the civil justice system, part of the redesignation of the courts that I described is really part of the review, because we are looking at how the civil justice system works, and we are seeking to make sure that all the practices that are there, the procedures, are reorganized in such a way that it suits the circumstances of today, so that society benefits as a whole. The review of the criminal justice system, you may have heard of it, again talk to the procedures in the criminal justice process and seek to revise them to make them more effective so that we can achieve what we want to do. I won't dwell much on state legal services. Really those are services of state law advisors and state attorneys on behalf of the state The next slide, the most important one there, are Objective 22 and Objective 23. Objective 22 talks to reducing state liability. You know that the state is sued many a time, the Minister of Police being the most sued minister, because of the conduct of the police sued on the basis that they believe they were wrongly arrested and so forth. So based on the summons that are issued, there's provision there that we always make for in the budget. Any year we make provision of about 6 billion. So then sometimes people shoot for 100 million. It doesn't mean you get 100 million or you get 100,000 sometimes. Because we never can predict what the judgments are going to say. We make provision for it so that we can pay. So that is important. You would have heard of an important constitutional court case of state, which is Nyasi, this is the MEC for Health and Housing. There was a judgment of the constitutional court issued yesterday, because in a number of cases, departments and judgments are issued against them. They take long to pay, or sometimes they don't make payment and drag and drag. In this case, Mr. Nyasi was a paraplegic, ended up suing the MEC for Health and Housing because the department was not paying the amount that the court had ordered in his favor. Unfortunately, he passed on before he could receive the money. But the point being made is that when his lawyer tried to attach state property to recover the amount, the State Liability Act, Section 3, prevents attachment of state property to execute a judgment. And therefore, it became a constitutional issue on the basis that one can't enforce his or her rights as a result of that provision. So the question now is, how are we going to revise the State Liability Act to be able to facilitate a framework in terms of which people can at least recover money that is owed to them as creditors by government following the judgment. It need not be by way of attachment, but there has to be a framework. So the judgment yesterday extended government time to put in place an appropriate amendment to the State Liability Act of 2011, but in the meantime the court made a proposal about how the money should be paid. So we make provision for this liability as far as the state is concerned. The other one, 23, talks to basically facilitating the closure of the fiscal statement when there is a deficit. Objective 25 talks to implementing CFC recommendations. Those deal with the reparations. The CFC reports made provisions that government needs to make sure that there are reparations to those identified victims past apartheid conduct by past members. These talk to rehabilitation of communities. They talk to provision of adequate infrastructure, educational infrastructure, clinics, and so forth. And the report that went to cabinet about 2 months ago talks to progress that government has made in that regard. There are other instances where there are remains of people that are found. They are exhumed by the NPA through the processes there, and investigations take place to try and establish the cause of people's death. And then those remains are returned to the families, and there are reburials that are organized, so symbolic burials that take place. The department does that work either through the NPA or through our TRC units, and therefore we offer assistance to those families by giving them $30,000. So the TRC recommendations provide amongst others for that type of assistance, and the department does provide that. In short, Chair, those are the key and broad objectives of the department. What I propose to do is then quickly run you through the budget so that you can see how the budget of the department is allocated. I won't go through all the slides. I'll just talk to the main one. This one is important just so that you can see the pattern of the department's budget. You can see in 2006-2007 it was 6.4 billion and it grew to those amounts. The current budget is about 8.5 billion, and therefore it has to be split accordingly. The expenditure has also been growing along those lines. In 2006-2007, we had an expenditure of about 600 million, because we spent 92.7, and then we implemented programs to make sure that we try as much as possible to spend the budget. In the immediate past financial year, we spent 99% of our budget. The breakdown of the budget, the large part of the budget goes towards court services, or 3.3 billion goes towards court services, which is all of the courts in the country, all of the personnel in the court, because that is core business of the Department of Justice. It's the criminal processes, it's the civil processes in the court, and therefore the personnel that provide those services get given that money. The NPA Program 4 gets the second biggest slice of the budget, 2.1 billion, again for the prosecutors and for running the various programs of the NPA. The auxiliary and associated services at the chapter 9 institutions that are listed there that provide services. Then the other part of the budget, which is the fourth highest amount, goes towards the salaries of the judiciary. Judges, they take about 370 million of the budget, and magistrates about 1 billion. The reason why it's different is because there's more magistrates than there are judges because of the way the court structure. A large part of our budget goes towards compensation of employees. It's a huge amount because we are a specific provision department more than anything else. This is an important slide. It just shows how we spend. The worst year was this one year, because as you can see the graph, we spent more in the last 2 months of the financial year. And the commonly used term for that period is the spike, the March spike, where everybody is said to be dumping towards the end of the financial year. People discover that money unspent, and they tend to spend a lot more. It doesn't always follow that people dump. It's just that some of the professional creditors submit their invoices that late. And sometimes for the December period, it's always very quiet because, key problems, everybody goes away, and invoices get submitted late January, early February. But when they get processed for payment, it's usually a month or two later, so the graph will usually look like that. But we've always tried to make sure that the graph improves. We see now that in the immediate past financial year, there is no spike sharp as it was in the previous 2 years. It actually goes down, just to make sure that we reorganize our budget, just to make sure that we pay. The important thing here is the second last bullet point, so it's OSD. The department also implemented OSD for each official pursuant to the agreement reached with between government and labor. The budget has been improved on that basis. For this current financial year, our budget is that amount there, representing 14.4% increase over time. So government has been relatively generous through the Department of Justice with respect to the budget because of the commitment government has towards the judicial craft. So our budget goes towards that area and also towards ensuring that courts perform functionally. I think that is the most important part of the slide, Chief. What slide 14 shows you is where the money goes. The biggest growth has been in court services. That one is the top. Court services, because again, that's where we carry out our services. Then the second one, the NPA, from the top, the second one, has been one where there's also been huge growth. Natural consequences of the environment, that's the core business, so we shouldn't be surprised by that. The next slide then further breaks the budget share in the manner that I've described. In the program of administration, the biggest part of our budget goes towards corporate services. That's the one there, and it's largely personnel. So, we shouldn't be surprised by that. The next biggest is accommodation. Accommodation is all leases where government officials are housed. They have to pay leases on an ongoing basis. So that's a huge amount there. With respect to court services, the big part of the budget, the lower court there, all the legislative court. That's a large part of where our budget goes. And the second one is the constitutional court. Any part of the budget goes to the constitutional court and the infrastructure that goes through. I think I'd like Chair to leave it at this, maybe touch briefly on program 4, the NPA, on slide 25. The public prosecution, the NPS, takes a huge chunk of that budget. The prosecution services functions largely through the prosecutor, so that takes a lot of the budget. And then administration, which is corporate services, takes the second most amount. Formerly, the DSO from next would be that work. So that budget would be moving over to the Director for Property Crimes Investigation in the police. Witness protection is the one second from bottom. Relative growth, marginal growth, not too much really, but effective nonetheless. Then the last one is asset compensation unit. I propose to not go any further, and I should just end by taking you to slide 32, that just shows you how the budget of the province is allocated. You see that how they responded in 33 million of the budget. It's a small province, but one that is quite busy. So a lot of resources go towards how they, the second one being KZN. Northern Cape, smaller population, especially spread out, gets 104 million budget. Chair, I'd like to leave it there and maybe allow members of the committee to ask questions. I'll just draw your attention to the last two slides on page 42 and 43, which talks to the pressures that we expect in the current financial year on a medium-term basis. We have pressure on accommodation. You know, there's about 20 million people in this country that are very poor that need service. So whenever there's an increase in demand for a service, you must have people that will provide the service. So you must create more posts and recruitment. So we always get faced with it, and we find that it's a big challenge. And as you recruit more people, you must find space for them, and so forth and so forth. So it's just a vicious cycle that goes on and on and on. So accommodation is a major problem for us, Chair. Again, issues of legislation. There's a lot of legislation that gets passed because of government policy and policy that the ruling party. Sometimes it's a major interest because it then costs a lot to implement, and sometimes you really discover the real implications as we are now faced with implementation. And when you look at the practices and the processes that legislation provides for, it's the type of services that you can't postpone just because you don't have the resources. You really have to find a plan and make sure that you deal with them. The Children's Act is one example. Social Development passed that legislation, which provided that every magistrate court must have a children's place to be able to assist, facilitate processes of adoption of children, placement of children that are vulnerable in appropriate environments, and so forth and so on. So what it means for the Department of Justice is that every court must have a children's place. So we must now create posts of children's place or designate people as children's place. But we must provide a human resource. But we don't have a budget for it. So we must make a plan and make sure that that work continues. So it's really things like that we have to provide for. Incidentally, the traditional court field, there's a presentation that speaks by the department to the relevant committee that talks to implementing that particular thing. The review of the criminal justice system spoken about is also putting us pressure from an expenditure perspective. Thank you very much.
Honourable members, thank you, Dr. Smada. I propose that before we engage with the presentation, we allow the NPA to do its presentation, and then we engage with the presentation after the NPA has presented. You can continue that today.
Thank you very much, Chair. With regard to our presentation, we would touch on a few issues. Firstly, just share with you the planning process we followed in developing our strategic plan. just overview of our strategic plan, including our budget allocation, and just make a brief closure. With regard to our planning process, we did our situation analysis. We developed a three-year strategic plan which informs the estimate of national expenditure submission we made to Treasury. Our strategic plan is cascaded through development of annual plans by various business units, and implementation is close to motion by Enterprise Performance Management Committee of the NPA. Under situation analysis, we took into account a number of factors, including the political, the economic, sociological, technological, relevant legislation, as well as the relevant environmental factors. We looked at government priorities, plans of our stakeholders, crime trends reported by various relevant surveys, and our various units of governance, delivery, and resources. We have attached a budget to the presentation, circulated check. I think the most important point that we want to make under the 2008-2009 expenditure outcome is that of the amount that was allocated for us, I think at that stage it was an amount of 2.1 billion. We managed to spend 98% of our budget for the 2008-2009 financial year. With regard to our strategy, it was reflected on a number of programs. The NPA as a whole, as the DG indicated previously, is program 4 in the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development Program. And it constitutes of a number of programs: public prosecution, witness protection program, Directorate of Special Operations, asset forfeiture unit, support services. I think the most important point to make is that we know that the Directorate of Special Operations is no longer on the establishment of the NPA, and we are just in the process of finalizing the disestablishment of the DSA. The next slide is budget allocation per sub-program. I think the most important point to make is that our original NPF allocation was 2.5 billion, but it was revised to 2.4 billion after the various cuts that were proposed by National Treasury amounting to 51 million, which constituted about 2% of our system budget. With regard to the financial year 2010-2011, our budget will be 2.618 billion. And with cuts of about 62 million proposed by National Treasury, all those cuts will constitute about 2% of our budget, given the economic recessionary conditions we are currently in. With regard to allocation to economic classification, you will notice, Chair, that most of our budget goes to compensation of employees, and the amount is about 1.8 billion, followed by goods and services at 507 million, followed by households, machinery, and equipment at 64 million, as well as smaller amounts for agency payments amounting to 1.4 million and software and other intangible assets at 12 million. With regard to budget allocation, I think the DG repeats to this point in this presentation. You'll notice that the National Prosecution Services take about 1.3 billion of our budget, followed by our support services at 256 million and then witness protection at 136 million. Others are amounts that various members of the committee can take into account. Now the question is, how do we use this budget? We are guided by our vision, which is justice in our society so that people can live in freedom and security. And our mission is guided by the Constitution. We and in the NPA ensure justice for the victims of crime by prosecuting without fear, favor, or prejudice, and by working with our partners and the public to solve and prevent crime. We are guided by a number of values: value of integrity, accountability, service excellence, professionalism, as well as credibility. We have a number of measurable objectives that we have set for ourselves. The first one being we want to increase the number of cases finalized in all courts by 2%, from 311,488 cases in the 2008-2009 financial year to about 313,551 cases in 2011-2012. We want to increase the number of cases finalized, including diversion, by 2% per year, from 393 in 2008-2009 to 420,559 in 2011-2012. We want to increase the number of cases finalized by SCCU, Special Commercial Crimes Unit, by 2% from 1,257 in 2008-2009 to 1,334 in 2011-2012. We want to establish 5 additional Tuprizella care centers per year, bringing a total to 30 in the financial year 2011-2012 from the current 15. Ensure that no witnesses are harmed or threatened while on the witness protection program, and reduce the percentage of witnesses that walk off the program from 16% in 2008-2009 to 10% in 2011-2012. We want to reduce the position of crime from the control of criminals by increasing the value of printing orders from 330 million in 2008-2009 to 420 million in 2011-2012. The next slide is really just a summary of what I'll be saying later on. I won't go into it in the interest of time, but it's just for members to know in a nutshell what our strategic framework is. With regard to sub-program one, the National Prosecuting Services provides prosecuting services in all courts in all 9 provinces. The Priority Crimes Litigation Unit focuses on serious national and international crimes. The Special Commercial Crimes Unit focuses on serious economic crimes. And the Sexual Offenses and Community Affairs Unit, better known as SOCA, develops strategy policy in cases of sexual offenses, domestic violence, human trafficking, maintenance offenses and young offenders. With regard to public prosecution, primary national responsibility for instituting criminal proceedings and performing related functions on behalf of the state, and includes the NPS, SOCA, SEC, and PCLU. And deals with public prosecutors and is staffed by public prosecutors and state advocates staffing the nation's district and high courts. Public prosecutors deals with criminal cases and arising appeals, litigation in ancillary matters involving the resolution of criminal matters outside of the formal trial process. This includes diversions, admissions of guilt, and providing data on court performance. Public prosecution will implement the following strategies. They will deliver a speedy, quality prosecution within the prescriptions of the law, build sound relations with key stakeholders and partners, use suitable alternatives to punitive justice, develop a dedicated commercial crime capability, develop the capability to successfully deal with cases affecting mainly women and children, and increase the number of Tuprizella cases. And the measures that they will take include decreasing the case backlog, increasing cases finalized, maintaining conviction rates, increase the use of alternative dispute mechanisms. They will also train prosecutors to deal with cases affecting mainly women and children, increase the number of Tuprizella care centers, and increase the number of cases finalized by the SCCU. I have included the number of targets that I mentioned earlier on. And I would like to go through. I will leave it for members' information. But with regard to number of backlog cases, you will notice that we intend to reduce this by 2% throughout from 2009-2010 right up to 2011-2012. Number of cases finalized through trial, we intend to increase this by 2% throughout the 3 financial years. Conviction rates in the high courts, we want to increase this starting with 86% from 2009-2010 financial year, right up to 87% in the coming outer 2 financial years. Conviction rates in the regional courts, we want to increase by 74% in the coming 3 financial years. Conviction rates in the district courts, they will increase by 87% in the 2009-2010 financial year. Again, 87% in the 2010-2011 financial year. And then we aim at 89% in 2011-2012 financial year. Sexual offenses costs, we intend increasing conviction rates with 66%, 67% in 2010-2011, and 68% in 2011-2012. number of preparation officers we intend increasing this, starting by 140 in the financial year 2009-2010, 150 in the financial year 2010-2011, and 160 in the financial year 2011-2012. Number of witnesses prepared will increase by 40 in this financial year, 50 in the next financial year, and 50 in financial year 2011-2012. I think I've already indicated some of these measures. Again, I won't go into too many details on them, except to indicate that with regard to improved justice training for the victims of sexual offenses, we want to train a number of prosecutors in various areas, starting with 550 in this financial year, increasing to 600 in the financial year 2010-2011, and then ultimately increasing to 650 in the financial year 2011 and 2012. I've already indicated that we intend increasing the number of Kutuvela care centers, starting with 20 in the 2009-2010 financial year, moving to 25 in 2010-2011, and then ultimately 30 in 2011-2012. This is a slide just indicating the budget for the various DPP offices. You'll notice that in Mabato, the budget has increased from 51 million to 62 million, a 21% increase. Bisho has increased from 34 to 37 million, which is a 10% increase. Bloemfontein has increased from 76 million to 89 million, which is a 16% increase. Cape Town has increased by 12%, Grahamstown 9%, Johannesburg by 25%, Kimberley 10%, Pietermaritzburg 20%, Pretoria 11%, and then Troyandroid has increased by 7%, and Inkatha by 13%. With regard to witness protection, the Office for Witness Protection provides a support services to the criminal justice system by the protection of threatened or intimidated witnesses and related persons by placing them under protection, thus ensuring that they will testify in criminal and other defined proceedings. The cooperation and liaison with relevant partners and stakeholders will underpin the strategy of witness protection. Protectors will be available on a 24/7 basis to expeditiously meet the demand for services. A holistic approach to protect witnesses will be followed, taking care of both their physical and mental well-being. Two important measures that will be taken by the Office for Witness Protection include ensuring that no witnesses are harmed or threatened while on the program, and reduce the number of witnesses that abandon the program. With regard to asset forfeiture is a criminal assets rather than prosecutor crime, or have been involved in the commission of an offense, either through a criminal or civil process. The AFE employs three strategies to reduce the incentive for crime, increase the impact of asset forfeiture, maintain a high success rate, as well as develop the jurisprudence, particularly given the fact that the focal legislation, the Prevention of Crime Act, is relatively new. The measures they will take include increasing the number of prison orders, increasing the number of completed forfeiture cases, increase the value of prison orders, increase the value of deposits into the criminal asset recovery account, increase the number of judgments obtained. With regard to support services, corporate services aims to ensure effective leadership, management, and administrative support to NPA through continuous refinement of organizational strategy and structure in compliance with appropriate legislation and best practice. The strategies that will be employed in support services include improving financial management, promoting and ensure compliance with relevant legislation and policies of government, improving stakeholder communication, improving strategy implementation, recruiting and retaining competent and skilled employees, improving information and IT systems management, improving efficiency of asset and supply chain management, as well as improving and the safety and security of our prosecutors. The measures that we'll undertake in this regard include ensuring that we have an unqualified audit opinion, we improve the level of customer satisfaction for both internal and external customers, improve the level of understanding of the prosecution, making sure that we reduce our vacancy rate, and provide training in terms of social skills development. And then the budget and expenditure status is attached. I think you will notice that on the slide that as of 31st of July overall, our expenditure today is about 29%, 28% mainly for compensation of employees and goods and services at 35%, all of which, including other items I haven't mentioned, adds to 29% of expenditure. I won't go into the slide on actual expenditure or just a special area. That's the budget for, that's the expenditure as of 31st of July for the various units. I think it's a self-explanatory. I also would like to go into it. With regard to the audit opinion, I need to indicate that the NPA has successfully addressed the audit opinion of a disclaimer in the financial year 2007-2008. And we have moved from a disclaimer to a current qualification in a number of areas. The CARU has moved from a disclaimer to an unqualified audit opinion, and the NPA therefore will focus on addressing the current audit findings. I think the DG has already mentioned the CJS review, to which we are active participants, and I won't necessarily go into it. And lastly, I just indicate that we are faced with a number of challenges despite the progress we have made. One is accommodation of prosecutors in the lower court, the issue of dedicated courts for sexual offenses and complex commercial crime prosecution, funding for Tutuzela centers, the need to improve on our audit outcomes, as I indicated, vacancies. Initially, we had a vacancy rate of about 27%. I'm happy to say we are now at 22%. We have advertised a number of posts, and we intend to reduce this vacancy rate from 22% to even lower. And we are currently, with the department of the DSO, and just the need to improve efficiency in general in the interior in the process of reviewing our structure. Lastly, we just need to make the point that the NPA will continuously strive to contribute to free our country from the shackles of crime and violence, and that the Constitution places a specific responsibility on us, and only by fulfilling this mandate as the prosecuting authority will we fully arrive at a vision of living in a racial, non-racist, and democratic South Africa, free of crime and poverty, where justice is enforced. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Dr. Gizzi. Honorable members, we can now engage with both presentations. Yes. Honorable Watson, followed by Honorable Bloom, Dr. Chani, and Dr. Matilda.
Can I pose both questions now, or do we handle one?
Yes.
Well, the DG presentation. On page 32, the regional budget allocations, I see there's no budget for master services at Mpumalanga. Is that the Master Supreme Court? Is that what it is? And then the question arises, why has nothing been done to solve the problem in Mpumalanga whilst all the other provinces have been helped? And on the same question, the DPP budget allocation on page 23 of it's actually not numbered, but it's the page between 22 and 24, so I assume it's 23. There again, if I look at the budget allocations for Mabatu, Bishu, Bloemfontein, etc., I find that all the provinces have allocations except Mpumalanga. Eastern Cape has no less than three. Mthatha, Grahamstown and Bishu, and Gauteng, of course, has Johannesburg and Pretoria, but yet again, Mpumalanga, nothing. And what are the plans there to establish these offices in Mpumalanga? You know, we often hear that Mpumalanga is the not the crime capital, but the province with quite a lot of white collar crime and what has been done about it. And also, the DG referred to accommodation of personnel. I assume that's office accommodation. material that you're selling. Okay. Those are my questions.
Honorable Bloom.
Chairperson, thank you very much. The first thing that I want to raise is, you see, Chairperson, if we want to do our oversight work very properly and successfully, you can't have this type of document circulated in a meeting. And we must engage the department with this type of document and think that we will ask proper questions in here. I will propose that when we are having briefings, Chairperson, at least 3 days before a briefing, this type of documents must be handed over to us so that we must sit and go through this document. But Chairperson, on the issue of docket disappearing in court or being stolen and from court, can the DG maybe tell us, or is it, but the DG raised that thing, how many of these dockets disappeared in the last financial year, and where, in which court are targets, or which provinces are this thing very rife? The other issue, Chairperson, is the break-in in court. Where is this thing rife? But my conclusion is, Chairperson, is that criminals don't have any respect anymore for the law. Because if people can go into a court, break into a court, then it shows that breakdown of law and order. Because that is a place, when I grew up, I was very scared even passing a court. But today, I mean, a criminal is targeting that place. He knows that magistrates and judges and whatever, and where is this thing happening? Thanks, Chairperson.
To the
Thanks, sir. I think I shared the view with one of them in terms of circulation of documents. I don't think it's fair for us to be bombarded with this kind of document now, and we expect them to interact with them immediately. So in future, if we can get them well beforehand, because these meetings are planned, I don't think that the department only knew this morning that they must come here. So, but nevertheless, my question, the other one will go to the NPA and the other one the DG will respond. I just want to check, maybe I might have missed the slide. In terms of your intention to fill the vacancies, I know you've got over 2,000 vacancies. This particular year, what number are you targeting? Because we still have got a huge shortage of magistrates in some of these courts. You find one magistrate having to handle a number of courts and more cases, I'm told, which makes their life very difficult. Because the whole thing of presiding over cases is quite a lot of involved work, particularly after the hearing itself. If you are to prepare the judgment and all those things, and to have magistrates dealing with more than 10 cases in a week, for an example, is quite unacceptable and too much. So this year only, we would want to know what is the target in terms of those particular figures, particularly for the magistrates. The reason why I'm raising this chair is that, for an example, in the Northern Cape, the prisons there are full of awaiting trials. And when you go to the police will tell you that, no, we are ready. We have arrested the people, we are ready, we have completed our investigation in the court. When you go to the court, the magistrate will tell you that you don't have staff. But at the same time, the people who are problematic, which brings me to the next question, are the this lawyer from the legal aid board. Their role seems to be postponement of cases every day. And yet they are paid for that service. They go to court more than anything, but only to postpone cases. Meantime, the government spends a lot of money to keep people at the prison. The situation in the Northern Cape is even, I don't know other prisons, but in the Northern Cape, those prisons are full of juveniles, some of whom are more than 11 months, 12 months in those particular prison cells awaiting trial. So I would want to know, in terms of what are you doing in terms of the, if it falls under yourself, this legal aid board, because I did not hear any of the slides. I might have missed as well talking to that. I don't know whether it's relevant to your section or what, but it should be because it's all under justice. The issue relating to that. And in terms of this migration or to e-filing, or you are going to use both manual and electronic system, how soon do you scan a manual file to be an electronic file to avoid the situation where is it an immediate thing, immediately after the file and everything necessary has been there, you immediately scan, or is it done after a certain period of time? That's going to be my third question. And the last one, the fourth one, the state of some of the courts. Some of the courts, particularly in the small towns, no man, those cannot be referred as courts. Very bad. With all banks and chains, the buildings are so filthy, but it's a court. What are we doing to begin to revamp those? I did not hear anything into that regard. Maybe somewhere in the budget that we are skipping some of the slides. But that is a serious cause for concern. I mean, that is why maybe, Honorable Bloom, the criminals are now beginning targeting the court, because sometimes you'll be mistaken that court to SAP. I've visited a number of them in the Northwest, the Volmar Randstad, those areas there. Their courts are in bad shape. What is it that you are doing? So that criminals begin to respect these courts like we used to as we were growing up. I'm sure all of us here, courts were highly regarded as very respected areas. But can it be the... So if you can just respond to that, Chair. Thank
you. Thank you.
The point I wanted to raise has been raised earlier, but you know, if you can have a breakdown of these vacancies, you know which areas. You see my worry here, you indicate when you make your input, you indicate that you are creating new vacancies, you're dealing with that, but you can't fill these vacancies, you know. You can't create new posts, you know, whilst you can't fill. 2,000 is a lot. 2,000 is a lot. That's why let's have an understanding as to, you know, what type of vacancies are we talking about here, you know. And you can't look for new budget whilst you can't use old budget, you know. I mean, this is a lot of money that is just sitting in the department because you can't fill those particular posts. And you understand it precisely because of that, you see, which is the problem. You know? Now, if you can have an understanding as to, because my colleague has just indicated here that a lot of courts lack magistrates. There's insufficient staff, you know, whilst you're sitting with more than 2,000 vacancies. Now, maybe the breakdown, it might be that these vacancies are not magistrates. And what type of people, what skills are you looking for? You know, that's the point I wanted to raise. Sure.
I'm worried about slide number 7 on the expenditure year-on-year comparison. This tendency to spend at the last 2 months, December or November, it's worrisome. It's like people have capacity to spend in 2 months, but they don't have capacity to spend in another 10 months. What type of? Why do we keep this type of people? And
they are also able to detect the reason that the claims come that time. I imagine a person who has provided service in January can come and want to get a claim in December. Is that a valid reason? To me, I'm very much suspicious, because if a person has provided a service in January, this person is hungry. I don't think he might be full in January and come and be hungry 10 months later. I think we need valid reasons here. What type of people are these? It's funny to me, really. It's not only this department. It's a tendency in other departments. They call it dumping. When we are saying our program should be performance based, do we have performance that ensure that the people who are charged with spending an operation are really doing that way? Because every time we receive performance measures, performance what, but do we adhere to this system? Because if we adhere to this system, wherein monthly we are able to say, or quarterly we are able to check the spending, some of these things will be solved. But I'm tempted to say I'm suspicious of this reason, that the last 2 months we are able to pay claims, programs, and all sorts of things, but we are unable to do this in the last in the 10 months that I exist in a year. Really. If these are the things that is the department, really, I think we need to make a self-review as a public. And maybe sometimes we need to have a minister, because he's the one that represents the parliament and the people. So as to indeed get results. Get results. Why? Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Chair. some of the generic questions that I wanted to raise, I think, Chair, they've raised it, like the ones on the accommodations. But, Chair, the issue of the, I think the teacher would perhaps confirm or share with us what are the problems. We are told that even there are vacancies with the magistracy, they only does once, or fill them or advertise for them once a year, it's like a fixed period of January, I think. And then that's it. Whatever the vacancies arises during the year, we don't do anything until the next year. Perhaps he could share with us. Is it because of the budget issues, or what are the issues really that caused that has made them to come to that position of filling those vacancies once a year? I think that also goes with the filling of the appointments of the prosecutor's chair. The quality of the prosecution. I don't know. I think it leaves much to be desired. And it's not because those professionals are perhaps have no integrity and do not do their work as such, but Chair, in the Northern Cape we saw a situation where almost one prosecutor per court is seen as normal. Chair, and there was even one court in Upington that has been standing empty, and those kind of situations, Chair, where it's really relating to to the vacancies as such. I don't know where it goes, this one, Chair, on the other professionals that are used in the justice system. Psychiatric professionals, so to speak, where it also causes, if there are people that need those kind of services of these other, I don't know who is in charge of, which is it a core department thing, or it's the main justice department to deal with this, because those also delay in finalizing matters, Chair, to assess people's state of minds and or mentality as such before dealing with matters and all that. Chair, when we had an opportunity for an information session with a judicial officer who raised issues of which leads me to ask a question around the department's plan, besides just filling the vacancies, some of the backlogs that are there, Chair, in terms of cases and many other things. If we do have, I think, in the prosecution, a way of really looking into matters that really don't require any trial, as such, which could be matters that could be, be subjected to plea bargaining, or any such intervention, Chair, as to are the professionals there, are down there, able to deal with this? Are we also, I think, Chair, there's a gap. Everybody wants to run to court for things sometimes that are not supposed to be. To be simply getting there, but I think, is it not now time that we do have a program that assists even before putting the people into the trial process, like a criminal case? There are civil matters, but the court is an unfriendly environment. Nobody advises you on anything, Chair. I met a man last week, a pound master, has taken his an illegal pound master, went to court, got a court order, took the whole man's 100 goats, and he's not working. Nobody to advise him where to go. He goes to court, the magistrate tells him, no, you must go find a lawyer. The man is not working. He's going to pay now for these goats that are taken. So I'm just saying, is it now, no time now that as Justice Department, as we look at it, it's not just the court service, that we render it, but also we find the prosecution working more and more and assisting in just awareness and getting people to to speak of diversion. I think the diversion are more used for children, is it? I think so, but there are matters I think also Chair needs to be looked at as part of matters that can go for diversion. I had a benefit of the briefing of the Child Justice Unit last week, Chair, so I will not raise those questions that perhaps we raised with the Child Justice with the view that we've agreed with them, that they will come back to that other committee. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I'd like to ask a question about are any of these prosecutors and magistrates undergoing any personality tests? We all know that all of us can't take the same amount of pressure, and I'm a bit worried that all the trouble we got in this whole system is the people who can't take it and who are unable to take it.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of court services, you would work to replace 46 of 203 to Branch Court to ensure that they provide full court service.
Do we have target
dates? When are you going to be able to achieve this? I'm raising this because in the morning, when one was traveling, there was on the news. I might not be able to represent the person that was reading the news. But the issue is about a case from a Johannesburg, I don't know, Randburg, I forgot. But the principle is that this person has been going to court for 4 years. I'm sure some of you might have heard about that. This person is not prosecuted. The prosecutor cannot even give sufficient reason why the case is not done. In such cases, is there a mechanism that type of people can make use of your department to intervene? Precisely because just imagine 4 years and beyond, this person might have been affected in his or her various needs of life. Maybe might have affected the way, might have affected relationship and all sorts of things. What should that type of people do in case they experience, you know, that length, wherein the case is not being placed in court from time to time for so many years, the person cannot do anything and the person cannot afford legal services. I might not be in a position to interpret it because I just heard it in dreams when one was driving.
There are two questions for me. One to Dr. De Beer with regard to the asset forfeiture. What do you do with the assets that has been forfeited from the criminals? And the one to Advocate Smedani with regard to the implementation of the TRC recommendations, particularly the pensions towards people who have been declared victims by the TRC. One of the requirements is that the people who should qualify are those who were actively involved in the struggle against apartheid or those who participated. But the criteria also mentions that the people should have been by then above the age of 35 so that they qualify for those pensions. I'm raising this issue because one of the complaints we received was with regard to mainly young children who were detained during the declaration of the national state of emergency and who were below the age of 35. That criteria put them aside to qualify for the pension. How do you respond to that? Honorable Bloom, you'll be the last one.
The last question, Chairperson. On the witness protection program. Chairperson, how many people are under this program? And what is the amount spent on one person per day on this program? Thanks, Chair.
In addition to that question raised by Honorable Bloom, you mentioned that some people leave the program. What makes them leave the program? Thank you very much. You can respond to the questions.
Thank you very much, Chair. And Honorable Members for the questions. With respect to the Master's Office in Mpumalanga, it's quite correct. We don't have a fully fledged office there yet, but we have put staff members to start offering some of the services, really around administration of the state, which is really basic services through our regional office. Ideally, what we would want to do is to have a full service, like in all of the provinces. We haven't been able to secure enough budget to make sure that we're able to do that. So some of the services are offered in Pretoria. It can only be offered in Pretoria. But we've put stuff there just to deal with the basics, just to get to issue letters of executorship and those types of things. We try, by all means, to make sure that they're issued from there so that nobody goes to Pretoria for this. But there are other services which can't be offered from there yet. So it's something we're progressing towards. With respect to the theft of dockets, I don't have the specific numbers say on how many were taken last year. I'd rather generalize and say, by and large, the way the, maybe the NPA will be able to have specific numbers, but I'm not quite certain that they may have readily now. But generally, I think the dockets are stolen in the two places, at court and at police stations. But those that, you know, are stolen at court, whilst I don't have the exact number, it's a problem that is not as widely existent as it used to. We believe that it's because, amongst others, of the strengthened mechanism that the police and the NPA have put in place to minimize dockets exposure. Because in the past, one of the reasons why, you know, it was relatively easy, it was the control mechanisms around the environment where the dockets are. So there have been process improvements in that respect. But we also believe that there's been improvements because we do scan them. By the time the dockets get to court, you know, they are really in the hands of an individual. It's either a prosecutor who's going to court already, and by that time they're already scanned, or it's a clerk of court who specifically has them. So it's not easy to intervene and steal a docket at that stage. You know, the issue of theft of docket is organized. You know, it's not like you'd get into a room and just find dockets all over the place. You'd really have to arrange with somebody. So it was really a question of control. And now that there's been that improvement, it's not as wide the thing as one would say. It's not a pandemic in that sense. But it is a problem that is there because almost in every court, there could be one or two dockets stolen maybe a month. So it's not something that one can say has been eliminated completely because it just is not our experience at this point in time. For as long as they are reported, it is a problem. But the extent of risk management interventions that have been put there, we are quite confident that they've significantly reduced the problem. Breaking the courts, again, I can't give you a specific number, but on average, I'd say I get notifications because whenever there's a break-in at a court or there's a theft of, we define them as security incidents. Whenever there's a security incident around the court, I get an SMS immediately once it's reported to security. I get about 3 a month security incidents that I can say would relate to either somebody attempting to escape from the cell, or if somebody has broken in. We normally discover these things when officials come to work, only to find that at a specific place, you know, the door was broken into. Sometimes it's not a break-in because sometimes there's no evidence of forced entry, which gives us an impression that somebody would have opened from one of our officials or security officials there. So we have those types of incidents. For purposes of stealing money, the most recent one that was reported to me last week was Northwest, where it did happen. It's something that happens, again, throughout the provinces. Mpumalanga I've never received a complaint about Mpumalanga and Northern Cape with that type of problem. As in the provinces, where one generally receives most of these complaints would be Gauteng, one gets in Northwest, and to a certain extent, KZN and Eastern Cape. But it's not a wide problem. It's not a wide problem. It's just that when it does happen, it happens around month end, when I think people know that there's a lot of money there. And we have reasonable basis to believe that sometimes it may very well be done together with officials, because only they would know either who's going to the bank to collect money or
how much money is collected at that point in time. But what it indicates, and the incident would indicate, in addition to what the honorable members have said, is the need to just have very tight security. Because at night, in some communities, there are no lights. So they have enough time to cut through the burglar bars. They have enough time to break in through the safes. Because those measures are there. I mean, there's no court really where there's usually a lot of money, where you find that there's not even burglar bars. So most of the time, and the minimum security that you put is a steel door or the burglar bar type of door on the windows and on the doors. But we found that people do cut on the safes as well. They do cut through the safes, which gives us a clear impression that they do have enough time to do it. It's not people who are in a hurry. So it's something that we're working towards. And one way of doing it is just eliminate money. You know, management of money is not a justice competence. It's not a justice function. You know, so it's something we're going to deal with in the future, together with the other stakeholders, in particular the judiciary. The vacancies are definitely not inclusive of vacancies in the judiciary. They definitely don't include the magistrates. Those are staff members. The department has about 16,000 officials countrywide. So most of the vacancies, they vary from your cleaner to a director or chief director. At this point in time, I think we even have two DDG posts vacant. The majority of the posts are at the below middle management level, which means your clerks. It's people that, you know, either easily find better paying employment, you know, get a clerk who gets a diploma, they immediately are able to move out of the department because they're able to get a job. We've done an analysis to try and see where mostly we lose our officials. We found that we lose them quite a lot at that particular level because of movement. They don't always move outside of the department. They move up sometimes within the department. But obviously they leave that that particular gap. So that number is a number that fluctuates depending on a particular point in time. So it's a number that really changes. But it doesn't include the magistrate at all. The Magistrate Commission is responsible for the recruitment of magistrates, and the JC also for the recruitment of judges. So they don't meet once a year, but they are set times. I think they meet 3-4 times a year at the most when they do these these appointments after a magistrate. So it's an issue we've raised with them to say that we'd like to see an environment where the processes of filling of posts of magistrates is more frequent. It's quite a cumbersome process, but it's something that we believe can be definitely improved on. There are interventions that have been implemented with respect to the Legal Aid Board assistance. The problem is broad. It's not only the Legal Aid Board. I think the experience that I remember mentioned may have related to the Legal Aid Board specifically, but we're aware that it's not only the Legal Aid Board. The problem arises in that, and we've seen this as part of the review, we are in what is called an arrest-friendly jurisdiction. In South Africa, you need to be arrested. You get arrested even before it's been established whether or not you're the one that committed a crime. So the incidences of arrest far outnumber any resources that are there. Then only after arrest, you know, do you now need, services provided for you, as we know. So the capacity that is there, the Legal Aid Board, notwithstanding the fact that they have worked very hard to fill their posts, and again, including the prosecution, they have worked hard to fill their posts. It's not a problem that I think is extremely problematic about the posts. It's just the volume of the cases that is a problem. There are just far too many cases. Notwithstanding the post. You know, if people on average have, 50 to 100 cases that are ending at any point in time, it's not an official problem that is there. It's a volume problem because of the work that gets done. But, they have made those improvements. The issue of postponement, I think it's one process that is being looked into. Postponements happen for a number of reasons. One of the common reasons for any postponement is because the case is not ready to be heard in terms of just the processes in the criminal justice system. It's not ready to be heard.
is still under investigation. So naturally it gets postponed. Majority of cases initially get postponed in the first few months to allow time for an investigation. And we don't have a problem with those postponements. The type of postponements we worry about are the postponements when a case is supposed to start, when a trial is supposed to start, then you find that there may be too many trials that the person is dealing with, and as a result, one can't be in one court has to go to another court. Yeah, that does happen. And that is something that we link up there to vacancy to see if it's occasioned largely by that or by just the volume. And, sometimes vary. Sometimes, yes, we do pick up that. We need to improve on the vacancy rate so that we minimize those. But sometimes it's just because there's too many cases being set down around that time. So we're looking at that holistically, and we're trying to have a balance. Remember that the more prosecutors you recruit, and the more vacancies you fill on that side, equally on the other side it must happen. Otherwise, it doesn't balance. So we have that type of balance that takes place on a regular basis. The scanning generally takes a day. In most of the courts, 90-95% of the cases are scanned exactly the same day. It's not always the whole file. It's usually really the charge sheet, which is the most important information. And because the matter is under investigation, the police keep the docket with, in some cases, the prosecution keeps the docket, but majority of times it's the police that keep the docket because they have to move with it as they carry the investigation. But so that the system has information about an individual, it's the charge sheet that we have, because the charge sheet is actually irrelevant. The most important part in the document are witness statements, because that tells you what the case is going to be about. A charge sheet only tells you the individual and the offense with which the person is going to be charged. So scanning is not our biggest problem. Cost and small time than the problem. There's a slide there that tells you about what is called the repair and maintenance program. The repair and maintenance program is managed on behalf of government departments by Public Works. So Public Works does the fixing of the courts, because if it interferes, if any intervention that has to be made interferes with the infrastructure, Public Works must come on board. Where the department has to do something itself is where, sweeping would be required, maybe cleaning of windows, and we try and have that done. Our budget for that type of work, we spend about 95-98% per annum. So we're quite comfortable about our expenditure. In fact, it's on slide 37. It tells you what is allocated, and our expenditure is quite huge in that respect. But it is a problem, and we are in continuous engagement with Public Works. In fact, it's something we can't outsource. We've tried it before, and the regulations of government don't allow us to do that. So it's something Public Works has to do for us. Slide 7 that talks to dumping. That slide indicates progression over a 3-year period. The time when we had the type of problem that the honourable member was talking to was in 2006-2007. We didn't have that problem in the past financial year. So really, we did make the type of intervention that helped us deal with that issue. We don't have a dumping problem in the department. But the point that the honourable member was raising about what occasions things like that are quite correct. It's really just managing processes. How we dealt with it, we looked at what payments we were making at that time of year, and we discovered that there are certain payments that have to be made every year. For example, your Microsoft licenses, because everybody uses it. The agreement that we had with Microsoft is that they would bill us only once a year, and at the end of the year. That's why we found that we were paying a huge amount of money at that time. So we revised the arrangement with them to say, no, rather allow us to split the amount. If it's 100 million per annum, let's split it over 12 months, and after each quarter when we perform the service, then we pay. So that's how we were able to reduce it. Public Works as well, it had they still do, in fact, have a habit of billing usually once a year. When they've done all your capital works, your construction for you and all of those things, they then come at a certain time of the year and give you a huge invoice. Then the process starts for us, where we have to double check and confirm the figures and we found that it creates a bit of a problem. So we've again engaged them to say, let's try, and as work gets done, gets completed, we get an invoice. So we found that we've managed that pretty well. So we think last year we didn't have a problem for those reasons. Yes, there are services that are offered by other departments out of the member. In criminal cases where somebody alleges lack of mental capacity, the person gets referred by the court for mental observation, goes to a mental hospital, and the Department of Health, because it's a government facility, then provides the psychiatry, and then we wait for that process to be completed. The law provides that the person can be sent for psychiatric evaluation 30 days at a time. But the practice has been that you get sent for 30 days. It doesn't have to be 30 days, but the practice is that you go there for 30 days, which can be extended by another 30 days or by another period. So those services are provided by the Department of Health. The counselors, with respect to family law matters that assist the family advocate, the Department of Social Development provides the social workers in some cases. So they are called in government agency agreements, where certain services are provided by one department on behalf of another, and then that department bills you, and then you pay. Those are also some of the services that contribute at the end of the financial year. So if a department that's inefficient and bills you only in January and takes time to double-check the invoices, you find yourself having to make the payments quite late. There are quite a number of payments that don't get managed to be made in time. We have to pay in April. And then because we work on a zero-based budget, you pay out of the following year's budget. So the issue of payments is one that has to be synchronized very well with everybody else. The excellent issue about the example of 100 goats, I think the most important thing is that that's a criminal case. So the police would be able to assist that individual in the prosecution and prosecute where somebody was apprehended and can be established that the person committed the crime. But on the point that the Honourable Member raises about the availability of legal services for civil matters to the indigent, it's a big challenge for government. It's a big challenge because, first in terms of the law, there's no obligation on government to assist you civilly. The Legal Aid Board arises out of a constitutional requirement that, the state must provide assistance to if the state accuses you of having committed a crime. That's where the Legal Aid Board comes from. But there's no equivalent provision in civil case. So there have been questions asked about the extent to which it is possible, or at least it should be looked into, that the Legal Aid Board also provides assistance to the indigent for civil matters. The Legal Aid Guide was amended last year to provide for the Legal Aid Board to give assistance in certain limited circumstances, especially where children are involved, it can assist. It can assist with respect to illegal farm evictions. You can go to the Legal Aid Board and in other cases. But government still has to reflect on the issue about how far to go because, that will have implications across the board. So it's something that has been discussed and is still under consideration on an ongoing basis. The issue of psychological testing, no, there's no requirement in the public service that when one gets recruited, so if it's a prosecutor or magistrate, one has to go for that type of testing. You can pick it up sometimes, when people go for competence assessment. And that happens really for your senior, from middle management, but primarily it's obligatory for SMS members, senior management service members, to undergo competence assessment. Sometimes you can pick it up there out of, but specifically to test the ability of people to stand pressure, there's no such requirement. So the answer is that it doesn't get that. And yet, sometimes you do reap the fruits of that type of situation. The target for branch court, the target we have is to do as many as possible. What determines the readiness is the availability of the infrastructure. Some courts are way too small, and if you have to provide all of the services, you only have the infrastructure to do that. But this year we targeted to do 50. 2 weeks ago, the minister, not 2 weeks ago, but a month ago, the minister designated nine as main and main course. So Alexandra is now a main course. Rheinberg is now a main course. And a couple of others which are counted called offhand, but the idea is that that number should improve. With respect to the special services, the Department of Social Development, I think the National Treasurer, are the ones that should deal best with that type of issue. My recollection is that there is legislation that specifically deals with this, and therefore, if there is going to be changes, there will have to be a revisit at that legislation. If I recall again, subject to correction, about 2 years ago, we did look into this with the National Treasurer. And I think it was a debate that eventually was resolved. I can't remember whether it eventually went to cabinet, but it was resolved against the changes in the use of 35 years. Because the intention at the time was to actually include a lot more people that fell out in the way that you described. But the conclusion that was made was that the law shouldn't be changed. So it's something that is closed as far as we are concerned. It's something that, unless advised differently, is considered closed. So I can't really talk further about that, but I would definitely understand the point the chair was making. Because, in fact, at that time, there was a concern about the number that were going to come in if there was a change, and because there was again a problem of verification, being certain that if any are those people that are supposed to be assisted. On the witness protection program, very rarely do people walk out of the program. Maybe walk out is not the right term to use. You know, in terms of the law, a person must be removed from the program when the testimony process has gone through. So you can't be in the witness protection program forever. At some point, you have to be released when your testimony has been completed. There are people that request to be released. So to be released from the program, you must make a request to say you'd like to leave. Maybe you've been there for too long. The case is taking too long. You are generally counseled and advised against it, and all the implications are explained to you. But the NTA, in terms of the program, cannot insist on keeping a person in a program if a person doesn't want to be. There have been cases, once or twice, where somebody just decided they are leaving and they just walked out. Nothing happened to that person. There's never been a person harmed after leaving the program, as far as we know, at least, or during the program. So people just decide to deal with the case without being part of the program. So, as far as the U.S. protection program is concerned, there really are no operational programs that we are aware of that we have. The only issue that is under consideration has been the amount of money that is paid to somebody whilst under the program. And there have been arguments that maybe the amount should be increased. I think the current amount is about 10 rand a day or something like that. And it's been argued that the amount should be increased to a higher amount, and that is currently under review. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. I think I should have started by apologizing for the absence of advocate, Chair, due to various commitments he couldn't make it. But I have here with me advocate Nyatu, advocate Nyatu, the head of the NPS. I think it will benefit the committee, Chair, if advocate Nyatu could also contribute to the process. The quality of prosecutors, whether prosecutors undergo personality tests, and what happens in situations where prosecutors delay cases. I think because he deals on a daily basis with this issue, I think the committee will benefit from his responses in that regard. Advocate Gog as well, if he feels the need to support Advocate Zinyati. The one question that I was asked was with regard to Mpumalanga. It was indicated that in terms of the slide provided on the budget allocation for DPP, there is no budget. In fact, maybe what I didn't clarify in my presentation here was that if you look at the budget for DPP Pretoria for 2008-2009, it was 247.6 million, and for this financial year, it has moved to 275 million. The budget from Mpumalanga. It's actually the main report in Mpumalanga. There's no high budget. But I don't know if Mr. Holombi could just indicate what is the specific cost of Mpumalanga is in that regard, if he has the figures with him. Next is the issue of breakdown of vacancies. I'm very pleased, Chair, to report that to date, since January, we have filled about 564 posts. We are pushing the various DPP office to make sure that we have about 144 interviews outstanding to finalize the post, some of the posts that have been advertised. And most important, we aim that by end of January, I think there have been further advertisements, and we aim that by January 2010, we should have filled an additional 200 posts, just to make sure that our vacancy rate gets reduced from 22% to between 10 and 15% at least of establishments. There was a question on asset forfeiture and what do we do with the assets taken from criminals. There's an account that has been created in terms by an act of parliament. I think it's called the POCA legislation, Prevention of Crime Act. The assets that have been taken from criminals are being deposited into that account. I think for the financial year 2008-2009, an amount of about 66 million that was deposited, and it's being used primarily through a committee check by the minister. And to use that money for the purposes of preventing crime in the country. With regard to how many witnesses we have on witness protection, we have a total of about 218, but if you include their families, the total is about 431. And really the amount depends on the needs of the various people because they are various needs. With regard to employee wellness programs, about 585 of our employees have benefited, 316 have benefited through telephone counseling, and about 488 have been assisted through face-to-face counseling regarding the various personal challenges they have experienced. I'll then leave the specific questions regarding prosecutors to answer the engineers.
Thank you, Chair. I think the NPA specific questions that I had flagged, Chair, by and large have been covered by both the TG and Dr. Tevia. How we manage or deal with stress levels of prosecutors, I think the doctor just answered that now. What happens to issues, rather what happens to assets seized, the whole issue of the criminal assets recovery account, Dr. Tivé just addressed that now, as well as the questions related to the Office of Witness Protection. I think the only specific question, Chair, that there's two that haven't received any specific attention. The question by the member about the use of diversions and alternative mechanisms, I will address that, as well as the issue of the delays in the courts and experience levels of prosecutors. My colleague Tukok will deal with that. Unfortunately, our slideshow was not numbered, Chair, but we did have a slide there in one of indicating one of our measurable objectives, the objective being to increase the use of alternative ways of delivering justice. What we planned there is essentially to focus on what the Honorable Member was talking about, diverting cases before they get into the formal court process. The strategy there is to use suitable alternatives to punitive justice. And the measure that we want to implement there is to monitor the number of cases that are finalized through this mechanism and to calculate the number of cases that have been finalized by means of diversion. We've got a target for the three-year cycle commencing with the current performance year. The slide is down the board now, Chairperson. We plan to, the target for the current year is 86,000 cases finalized by means of other alternatives other than court, and the total for diversion that we plan is in the region of 400,000. And the number for the following year is 88,000 use of alternatives, diversions generally is 412. And in the third year of the cycle, we are intending to do 90,000 and 420 respectively, as indicated on the slide. Thank you very much.
Just in response to the final question, the question of delays in finalizing of cases is an absolute priority for the MPA. So to the extent that there are issues within the power of the MPA that needs to be addressed, it is something that all directors of public prosecutions are supposed to monitor within the provinces with the help of the senior management of a particular area. So those include the chief prosecutors that are appointed in a particular province, as well as the senior public prosecutors, who are really the managers responsible for the day-to-day management of cases in our various courts. So we obviously have those systems in place that's supposed to ensure that the monitoring of those cases takes place. However, we do have a number of cases that are long outstanding on court rolls. Those cases are currently, we've received, each province have received the list of cases that are older than 2 years on court rolls, and each director of public prosecutions have been specifically requested to look at those particular cases and what interventions are being made to ensure that those cases are finalized. There, for example, the DPP will have to meet, for example, with the regional court president in the respective areas. Because ultimately the case flow management is the responsibility of the judiciary. And so your chief magistrate, your regional court presidents are now responsible to ensure that cases are speedily finalized on our court rolls. And so the prosecution has to constantly interact with the judiciary to ensure that we do everything that is necessary to get a case speedily resolved. The DPP is then, in the particular instance, where we look at this case, what are the reasons that we often find why cases are being delayed on court rolls? The majority of the instances that come up is actually the accused person themselves. You may find that accused persons replace their legal representatives continuously. I, for example, in the Western Cape, a case in Cape Town Magistrates Court had a charge sheet that was presented to me where I think the particular accused has changed his representative about 12 times. So these things create problems for the court itself. A court is very unlikely to proceed with a case if a legal representative is not there, particularly in the serious cases for the accused. So these are some of the instances. Legal representation. The other area, in terms of the long-outstanding cases, is often where there are multiple accused. So when you have 3, 4, 5, sometimes more accused in a particular matter, it leads to all sorts of complications, including the question of the lawyer for each of them. Often you can't use the same lawyer. And then sometimes there's other problems, in particular, they need to bail, they don't come back to court. In a case like that, you will find it is found often for many, many times in order to get that case out. And even when you start that particular trial in our lower courts, because of the number of accused, it also takes a long time to finalize those cases. So what we find is that it is often not the fault of the prosecution that these cases are being taking a long time to follow. It's a complex scenario that unfolds because of all the different role players that have to cooperate with each other in a court to ensure that the court that the case proceeds speedily on all occasions. But the point, in summary, is that we are giving attention to awaiting trial detainees because it is a matter of priority for the MPA, and that all long outstanding cases on our court rolls is requiring the necessary attention of the DPP to ensure that those cases, that we find those cases to finalize them as quickly as possible.
think that is all I wish to say. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other questions from other members? Dr. Matthew.
Chair, we hear this the answer around the postponement of cases. I mean, an example, a few years ago, it was in the media, where a woman has stayed for 5 years on trial in prison. At the end of the day, charges were withdrawn, the Mashele case. Charges were withdrawn, and then nothing happened. But that person stayed for 5 years. And we're not sure, because you know, usually she came to court, it was postponed, and it was the reasons that were given there, cases still being investigated. I'm saying, you know, how many people are sitting in that particular situation? I mean, my colleague has just raised a 4-year one that is sitting now. But, you know, it will be important for us to be given an idea as a committee as to how many people are sitting in that situation enough. Because, you know, we're told that jails are overcrowded. And we still have people that are sitting that way in those particular jails. And at the end of the day, charges are being withdrawn. Is the problem with is it a problem with the justice system? You know, the prosecution, or is it a problem with the investigative system? You know, one that does not know, and we need to find some answers as to why cases drag on the table.
Louis, someone can we talk with you?
Sure. Chair, I think in line with what the previous my colleague and my previous speaker said, Chair, I would like to, I don't know who of the members of the team, Chair, would share with us, you know, their understanding, because part of these delays and is this bail matter, Chair, when you know, the role of the state with this issue of bail, you know, Chair, if they could share with us, because also part of the problem why there's so many people in jail are people who can't afford to pay 300 rand bail and things like that. I mean, why money would be put as a main issue if somebody says no harm, really, except in circumstances where there's potential for serious harm and interference with the matters before the court. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the two questions, the issue of postponement, there are, I think as of 2 months ago, that's the last information I had, there were at least 5 people that have been awaiting trial in custody for over 5 years. There are 5. We did a check with correctional services as a cluster to see. There were specifically 5. And their cases were going to be looked into to check why. The case that the Honourable Member referred to of Ms. Mashele, I think she had been awaiting trial for 7 years. Amongst others, the main reasons why that usually happens, that generally cases where the prosecution is waiting for the police to conclude the investigation. And invariably in all of those cases, there are multiple charges against an individual. It's usually never one. It's maybe 4 or 5 different charges. And one may be completed, but the others, because they are linked, may still be under investigation. So the issue that government has been looking into as a class is to say, how are we going to conclude on those matters? So, for example, if somebody were awaiting trial, let's say for 3 years, how should government deal with it? Should government say, if you've been waiting for longer than this period, you should be released? If you have not got bail, if you've been granted bail, yes, you can then pay bail and then you are released. But if you've been denied bail and you've been awaiting trial for 4 years, what is the answer? Should those people be released? So that's the debate that's currently going on in government underway to try and find solutions to these types of issues. It's been clearly recognized that one of the areas in which we can make a specific intervention is to find a way of speeding up police investigation. So at least the police must be able to say there's no prospect of us finding evidence. So we're not going to move on this unless something comes up. But for now, on what we have, we can't move on. Maybe at that stage, the person can then be released, you know, and rearrested if something happens, you know, or something comes up later. But it's a debate that is there. There are about 10,000 awaiting trial detainees as we speak throughout the country. Of those, you know, there's about 2,500, 3,000 that have been granted bail of at least 2,500 rand or less. But it's a number that is huge. Again, that discussion to look at how those types of cases can be dealt with holistically. It's not a problem of one specific department. It's a problem at least of three departments: the police, justice through the prosecution service, and the correctional service. So it's an ongoing debate. No, sorry, I made a mistake. It's 10,000 awaiting trial detainees who have been granted bail of 2,500 and less. There are about 56,000 awaiting trial detainees all in all. So that's those are the figures around which we are having this discussion. With respect to the issue of bail, yes, the honourable member is correct. That point has also been considered to say it may actually be cheaper, if properly calculated, for government to pay bail for those that have been granted bail as opposed to keeping them, because it costs more to keep them in their correctional facility for that long. But it's not something that's done anywhere in the world, so it's unlikely that that type of suggestion will find favour. But on the issue of money, the Criminal Procedure Act does provide for other means of securing one's attendance in court. Bail in the form of money is one most effective way, on the belief that, and it's a tradition, that if you put money, you're going to want your money back. If somebody offers to put shoes, they may not want their shoes back. So they may not have an incentive to come back to court. So the general practice has been to say, how do you incentivize somebody to come back to court if you're going to release them? And one way of incentivizing them is to put a money amount, and then which they get back once they've appeared. But if you put any other thing, you know, it's generally foreseen that that person may not want to come back. That's why there's an emphasis more on the money. But the issues that both of the members have raised are issues that are currently being discussed and evaluated as part of the review of the criminal justice system. Thank you, Chair.
Any other questions from our members? In the absence of none, let me take the opportunity to thank both the DG Advocates Melani and Dr. Devier and their team for appearing before the committee, and also hope that we will get the same cooperation next time we request them to appear before the committee, so that will make our monitoring and oversight duty very, very simple. Thank you very much. You are released.
Thank you very much, Chair. Honorable members.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.